It was the Princess Sorokina with her daughter who came to bring me the money and documents from Maman. I could not get them yesterday. How is your head? Better? He said, quietly, not wishing to see or understand the gloomy and solemn look on her face. She stood silent in the middle of the room, looking at him intently. He glanced at her, frowned for an instant, and continued to read a letter. She turned and slowly moved from the room. He could still call her back, but she reached the door and he remained silent, and only the rustle of the paper as he turned a page was heard. "Oh, by the way," he said when she was already in the doorway, "we are definitely going tomorrow, aren't we?"
"You." "But not I," she said, turning round toward him.
"Anna, it is impossible to live like this."
"You, but not I," she repeated.
"This is becoming intolerable."
"You.
You will repent of this,"
she said, and left him. Alarmed by the despairing look with which she had said these words, he jumped up, intending to run after her, but, recollecting himself, he sat down again, tightly clenching his teeth and frowning. This, as it seemed to him, unbecoming and indefinite threat irritated him. "I have tried everything," he thought. "The only thing left is to pay no attention." And he began getting ready to drive to town and to go again to his mother's to obtain her signature to a power of attorney. She heard the sound of his steps in the study and dining room. He paused at the drawing-room door, but he did not return to her. He only gave an order that they should let Vojtov have the horse in his absence. Then she heard the carriage drive up and the door open, and he went out again. But now he re-entered the hall, and someone ran upstairs. It was his valet, who had come for the gloves his master had forgotten. She went back to the window and saw him take the gloves without looking, and having touched the coachman's back with his hand, say something to him. Then, without turning to look up at the window, he sat down in the carriage in his usual posture, crossing one leg over the other and, putting on a glove, disappeared round the corner.
Chapter 27.
"Gone. Is it finished?"
said Anna to herself as she stood by the window. And in answer to that question, the impressions left by the darkness when her candle went out and by the terrible dream merging into one filled her heart with icy horror.
"No, it is impossible," she exclaimed,
and, crossing the room, she rang loudly. She was so terrified at being alone that she did not wait for the servant, but went out to meet him. "Find out where the Count has gone," she said. The man replied that the Count had gone to the stables. "The Count told me to let you know that, in case you should wish to go out, the carriage will return very soon."
"Very well. Wait a moment. I will just write a note. Send Mikhail with it to the stables at once. Quickly!"
She sat down and wrote. "I was to blame. Come home. We must talk it over. For God's sake, come. I am frightened." She stuck it down and gave it to the man. Then, afraid to remain alone now, she followed him out of the room and went to the nursery.
"How is this? Oh, that's not it. This is not he. Where are his blue eyes and his sweet, timid smile?"
was her first thought on seeing her plump, rosy little girl with curly black hair instead of Seretse, whom, in the disorder of her mind, she had expected to find in the nursery. The little girl, sitting at the table, persistently and firmly hammered on it with the stopper of a bottle, gazing blankly at her mother with her two black currants of eyes. Having, in answer to the questions of the English nurse, said that she was quite well and that they were going to the country next day, Anna sat down beside the child and began twirling the stopper round in front of her. But the child's loud, ringing laughter and a movement of her eyebrows reminded Anna so vividly of Vronsky that, Repressing her sobs, she rose hurriedly and left the room.
Is it really all over? No, it cannot be, she thought. He will come back. But how will he explain to me that smile and his animation after he had spoken to her? But even if he does not explain it, I will believe him all the same. If I don't believe him, there's only one way left for me.
And I don't want that. She looked at the clock. 12 minutes had passed. Now he has received my note and is on his way back.
It won't be long. Another 10 minutes. But supposing he does not come? No, that's impossible. He must not find me with red eyes. I'll go and wash them. Oh, and did I brush my hair or not?
She asked herself, but could not remember. She felt her head with her hand.
Yes, my hair was done, but I don't in the least remember when.
She did not even trust her hand and went up to the mirror to see whether her hair really was done or not. It was, but she could not remember doing it.
Who is that?
She thought, gazing in the mirror at the feverish, frightened face with the strangely brilliant eyes looking at her.
Yes, that is I,
she suddenly realized, and looking at her whole figure, she suddenly felt his kisses, shuddered, and moved her shoulders. Then she raised her hand to her lips and kissed it.
What is it? Am I going mad?
And she went to her bedroom, where Anushka was tidying up.
Anushka,
she said, stopping before the maid and looking at her, without knowing what she would say to her.
You wish to go to see the Princess Oblonskaya, said the maid, apparently understanding her.
Darya Alexandrovna? Yes, I will go. A quarter of an hour there, a quarter of an hour back. He is already on the way. He will be here in a minute.
She looked at her watch.
But how could he go away, leaving me in this condition? How can he go on living without having made it up with me?
She went to the window and looked out into the street. He might have got back by this time, but her calculations might be incorrect, and again she began trying to remember when he had left and reckoning the minutes. Just as she was going to compare her watch with the large clock, someone drove up. Glancing out of the window, she saw his calèche. But no one came upstairs, and she heard voices below. Her messenger had returned in the carriage. She went down to him.
I did not find the Count. He had gone to the Nizhivni railway station, he said.
What do you want? What is this?
She asked the rosy, jolly-looking Mikhail as he handed her back her note.
Oh, of course, he did not receive it, she remembered. Go with this note to the Countess Vronskaya's country house. Do you know it? And bring back an answer at once, she told the man. What shall I do myself? She thought. Yes, I will go to Dolly's, of course, or else I shall go out of my mind, and I can telegraph as well.
And she wrote out a telegram. I must speak to you. Come at once. Having sent off the telegram, she went to dress. Ready dressed and with her bonnet on, she again looked at Anushka's placid and now still rounder face. Evident compassion showed plainly in those kindly little grey eyes.
Anushka, my dear, what am I to do?
Muttered Anna, sobbing, as she sank helplessly into an armchair.
Why take it so to heart, Anna Arkadyevna? Such things will happen. Go out and get it off your mind, advised the maid.
Yes, I will go,
said Anna, recovering and rousing herself.
And if a telegram comes during my absence, send it to Darya Alexandrovna's. No, I'll come back myself. But I must not think. I must do something. Go away, get out of this house at any rate, she said to herself,
listening with horror to the terrible beating of her heart. And she hurriedly went out and got into the calèche.
Where to, ma'am? Asked Piotr, before getting onto the box.
To the Oblonskys, on the Znamenka.
Chapter 28. The weather was bright. All the morning there had been a fine, drizzling rain, but but it had now just cleared up. The iron roofs, the pavement flagstones, the cobbles of the road, the wheels, the leather, brass, and tin of the carriages all shone brightly in the May sunshine. It was 3 o'clock, the busiest time in the streets. Sitting in the corner of the comfortable calèche, which rocked gently on its elastic springs to the rapid trot of the pair of greys, Anna, amid the incessant rattle of wheels and the rapidly changing impressions in the open air, again going over the events of the last days, saw her position quite differently from what it had seemed at home. Now the idea of death no longer seemed so terrible and clear, and death itself no longer seemed inevitable. She reproached herself now with the humiliation to which she had descended. "I entreated him to forgive me. I have surrendered to him. I have confessed that I am to blame. Why? Can I not live without him?" She began reading the signboards. Office and stores. Dental surgeon. "Yes, I will tell Dolly everything. She is not fond of Vronsky. It will be humiliating and painful, but I will tell her everything. She is fond of me, and I will follow her advice. I won't submit to him. I won't let him educate me. Filipov, bakery. It is said that they send dough to Petersburg. The Moscow water is so good. Oh, and the wells in Mutishi, and the pancakes." And she remembered how, long, long ago, when she was only 17, she visited the Troitsa monastery with her aunt. "We drove with horses, for there was then no railway. Can it really have been I, that girl with the red hands? How many things that then seemed to me excellent and unattainable have since become insignificant, and things that then existed are now forever unattainable. Should I then have believed that I should descend to such humiliation? How proud and satisfied he will be to get my note, but I will show him. How nasty that paint smells. Why are they always painting and building? Dressmaking and millinery," she read. A man bowed to her. It was Annushka's husband. "Our parasite," she remembered how Vronsky had said the words. "Our? Why our? It is dreadful that one cannot tear out the past by the roots. We cannot tear it out. But we can hide the memory of it. And I will hide it." At this point she recollected her past with Karenin, and how she had effaced the memory of him. "Dolly will think I am leaving a second husband, and that I am therefore certainly unjustifiable. Do I want to be justified? I can't," she said to herself, and wished to cry. But she immediately began to wonder what those two young girls could be smiling at. Love, probably. They don't know how far from joyous it is, how low. The boulevard and children, three boys running about playing at horses.
Tsaretsa. And I shall lose everything and shan't get him back. Yes, I shall lose everything if he does not return. He may have missed the train and be back already.
Wanting to humiliate yourself again, she said to herself. No, I shall go to Dolly's and will tell her frankly, I am unhappy. I deserve it. I am guilty, but all the same, I am unhappy.
Help me.
These horses, this carriage. How horrid it is of me to be in this carriage. They are all his. But I shall not see them any more.
Is anyone here? She asked in the anteroom.
Katrina Alexandrovna Lyovina, answered the footman.
Kitty. That same Kitty with whom Vronsky was in love, thought Anna. She whom he remembered affectionately.
He regrets not having married her, and of me he thinks with hate, and regrets having joined himself to me. When Anna arrived, the two sisters were consulting about feeding the baby. Dolly went out alone to meet the visitor who at that moment had come to interrupt their talk.
"So, you have not left yet? I was myself coming to see you," said Dolly. "I had a letter from Stiva today."
"We also had a telegram from him," replied Anna, looking round for Kitty.
He writes that he cannot understand what Alexei Alexandrovich really wants, but that he won't leave without getting an answer.
I thought you had a visitor. May I see the letter?
Yes. Kitty, answered Dolly with embarrassment. She is in the nursery. She has been very ill.
I heard about it. May I see the letter?
I will fetch it at once. But he is not refused. On the contrary, Stiva is hopeful, added Dolly, pausing at the door.
I have no hope, and don't even desire it, said Anna.
What does it mean? Kitty considers it humiliating to meet me, thought Anna when she was left alone.
Well, maybe she is right.
But it is not for her, who was in love with Ronsky. It is not for her to let me feel it, even if it is true. I know that no respectable woman can receive me in my position. I knew that from the first moment I sacrificed everything for him, and this is the reward. Oh, how I hate him! And why have I come here? It is still worse for me. It is harder than ever.
She heard the voices of the sisters conferring together in the next room.
And what am I going to tell Dolly now? Console Kitty by letting her see that I am unhappy and letting her patronize me? No, and even Dolly would not understand. It is no use speaking to her. But it would be interesting to see Kitty and show her how I despise everybody and everything. How indifferent everything is to me.
Dolly came back with the letter. Anna read and silently returned it. I knew it all, she said, and it does not interest me in the least.
But why?
I, on the contrary, am hopeful, said Dolly, looking at Anna with curiosity. She had never seen her in such a strange and irritable mood. When are you leaving? She asked. Anna, screwing up her eyes, gazed straight before her without answering.
Is Kitty hiding from me, then?
She asked, looking toward the door and blushing.
Oh, what nonsense! She is nursing her baby and has difficulty with it, and I was advising her. She is very pleased. She will come directly,
Dolly said awkwardly, not knowing how to tell an untruth.
Oh, here she is.
When she heard that Anna had come, Kitty did not wish to appear, but Dolly persuaded her. Having mustered up her courage, Kitty came in and, blushing, went up to Anna and held out her hand.
I am very pleased,
she began in a trembling voice. Kitty was confused by the struggle within her between hostility toward this bad woman and a desire to be tolerant to her. But as soon as she saw Anna's lovely and attractive face, all the hostility vanished at once.
I should not have been surprised if you had not wanted to see me. I have got used to everything. You have been ill?
Yes, you are changed, said Anna.
Kitty felt that Anna looked at her with animosity. She attributed that animosity to the awkward position Anna, who had formerly patronized her, now felt herself to be in, and she was sorry for her. They talked about Kitty's illness, about the baby, and about Stiva, but evidently nothing interested Anna.
I came to say goodbye to you, she said, rising. When are you leaving?
But Anna again, without replying, turned to Kitty.
Yes, I am very glad to have seen you, she said with a smile. I have heard so much about you from everybody, and even from your husband.
He called on me, and I liked him very much, she added, with obvious ill intent.
Where is he?
He has gone to the country, answered Kitty, blushing. Remember me to him.
Be sure you do.
I will be sure to, repeated Kitty naively, looking compassionately into her eyes.
Well then, goodbye, Dolly.
And kissing Dolly and pressing Kitty's hand, Anna hurried away.
She is still the same, and as attractive as ever.
Charming, said Kitty when she was once more alone with her sister.
But there is something pathetic about her.
terribly pathetic. Yes, but today there is something peculiar about her, said Dolly. When I was seeing her out, there in the anteroom, I thought she was going to cry.
Chapter 29 Anna reseated herself in the calèche in a state of mind even worse than when she left home. To her former torments was now added a feeling of being affronted and repudiated, of which she had been clearly sensible during the meeting with Kitty.
"Where to, ma'am? Home?" asked Piotr.
"Yes, home," she said, now not even thinking of where she was going.
How they looked at me, as at something dreadful, incomprehensible, and strange. What can he be telling that other man so warmly, she thought, glancing at two pedestrians.
How is it possible to tell another what one feels?
I meant to tell Dolly, but it's a good thing I didn't. How glad she would have been at my misfortune. She would have concealed it, but her chief feeling would have been joy that I am punished for the pleasures she has envied me. Oh, Kitty would have been still more pleased. How well I can read her. She knows I was more than usually amiable to her husband. She is jealous of me and hates me, and she also despises me. In her eyes, I am an immoral woman. If I were immoral, I could make her husband fall in love with me, if I wanted to. And I did want to. There is someone satisfied with himself, she thought, seeing a fat, ruddy man who was driving past in the opposite direction, and who, taking her for an acquaintance, lifted his shiny hat above his bald and shiny head, but then discovered that he was mistaken. He thought he knew me, but he knows me as little as does anyone else in the world. I don't even know myself. I know my appetites, as the French say. Those boys want some of that dirty ice cream. They know that for a certainty, she thought, as she saw two boys stopping an ice cream vendor, who lifted down a tub from his head and wiped his perspiring face with the end of the cloth. We all want something sweet and tasty. If we can get no bonbon, then dirty ice creams. And Kitty is just the same. If not Vronsky, then Levin. And she envies and hates me. And we all hate one another. Kitty me and I Kitty. Now that is true. Kyutkin coiffeur. Je me fais coiffeur par Kyutkin. I shall tell him that when he comes back, she thought, and smiled. But just then she recollected that now she had no one to tell anything funny to. Besides, there is nothing amusing or merry. Everything is nasty. They are ringing for vespers, and how carefully that tradesman is crossing himself, as if he were afraid of dropping something. What are those churches, that ringing, and these lies for? Only to conceal the fact that we all hate each other, like those cabmen who are so angrily swearing at one another. Yashvin says, he wants to leave me without a shirt, and I him. Now that's true. With these thoughts, which occupied her so that she even forgot to think of her troubles, she arrived at the porch of their house. Only when she saw the hall porter coming out to meet her did she remember that she had sent the note and the telegram. "Is there an answer?" she asked.
"I will look," he replied,
and glancing at his desk, he took up and handed her the thin, square envelope of a telegram.
"I cannot return before 10. Vronsky," she read.
"And the man has not yet returned?"
"No, ma'am," answered the hall porter.
"Well, in that case, I know what I must do," said she to herself.
And conscious of a vague sense of wrath and a desire for vengeance rising within her, she ran upstairs.
"I shall go to him myself. Before quitting him forever, I will tell him everything." "I never hated anyone as I hate that man," thought she.
Seeing his hat on the hat rail, she shuddered with aversion. She did not realize that his telegram was in answer to hers and that he had not yet received her note.
She imagined him now calmly conversing with his mother, the Princess Sorokina, and rejoicing at her sufferings.
Yes, I must go at once, she thought, not yet sure where to go to.
She wished to get away as soon as possible from the feeling she experienced in that terrible house. The servants, the walls, the things in the house all repelled and angered her and oppressed her like a weight.
Yes, I must go to the railway station, and if I don't find him, I must go there and expose him.
She looked at the timetable published in the daily paper. The train left at 8:02 p.m. I shall have time. She gave the order to harness another pair of horses and busied herself packing her handbag with things necessary for a few days. She knew she would not return. She vaguely resolved on one of the plans that passed through her mind. After what would occur at the railway station or at the Countess's estate, she would go on by the Nizhivni railway to the first town and remain there. Dinner was served. She went to the table, smelt the bread and cheese, and as the smell of everything eatable revolted her, she sent for the carriage and went out. The house already threw a shadow right across the street. The evening was bright and the sun still warm. Anushka, who came out with Anna's things, and Pyotr, who put them into the carriage, and the coachman, who was evidently dissatisfied, were all objectionable to her and irritated her by their words and movements. I shan't need you, Pyotr.
But how about your ticket?
Well, as you like, I don't care, she replied with annoyance.
Peter jumped up on the box and, with his arms akimbo, told the coachman to drive to the station. Chapter 30.
There. Again it is that girl. Again I understand it all, Anna said to herself as soon as the carriage started, and, rocking slightly, rattled over the stones. And again different impressions succeeded one another in her brain. What was the last thing I thought of that was so good? She tried to remember it. Cutekin coiffeur? No, not that. Oh, yes, what Yashvin said. The struggle for existence and hatred are the only things that unite people. No, you are going in vain, she mentally addressed a company of people in a calèche with four horses, who were evidently going out of town on a spree. And the dog you have with you won't help you. You can't escape from yourselves. Glancing in the direction in which Pyotr was looking, she saw a workman, nearly dead drunk, with his head swaying about, who was being led off somewhere by a policeman. That one is more likely to, she thought. Count Vronsky and I have also been unable to find that pleasure from which we expected so much. And now, for the first time, Anna turned the bright light in which she saw everything upon her relations with him, about which she had always avoided thinking. What did he look for in me? Not so much love as the satisfaction of his vanity. She remembered his words, the expression of his face, suggestive of a faithful setter's in the early days of their union. Everything now confirmed her view. Yes. There was in him the triumph of successful vanity. Of course, there was love, too, but the greater part was pride in his success. He boasted of me. Now that is past. There's nothing to be proud of, not to be proud, but to be ashamed. He has taken from me all he could, and now he does not need me. He is weary of me, and he is trying not to act dishonorably toward me. Yesterday, he betrayed himself. He wants the divorce and a marriage in order to burn his boats. He loves me. But how? The zest is gone, she said to herself in English. That man wants to astonish everybody and is very well satisfied with himself, she thought, glancing at a rosy-faced shop assistant who was riding a hired horse. No, I have no longer the right flavour for him. If I go away, he will, at the bottom of his heart, be pleased. That was not a surmise.
She saw it clearly in the piercing light which now revealed to her the meaning of life and of human relations.
My love grows more and more passionate and egotistic, and his dwindles and dwindles, and that is why we are separating, she went on thinking. And there is no remedy. For me, everything centers in him, and I demand that he should give himself up to me more and more completely. But he wants more and more to get away from me. Before we were united, we really drew together, but now we are irresistibly drifting apart, and it cannot be altered. He tells me I am unreasonably jealous, and I have told myself that I am unreasonably jealous, but it is not true. I am not jealous, but dissatisfied. But...
She opened her mouth and changed her place in the carriage from agitation produced by a sudden thought.
If I could be anything but his mistress, passionately loving nothing but his caresses. But I cannot and do not want to be anything else. And this desire awakens disgust in him, and that arouses anger in me, and it cannot be otherwise. Don't I know that he would not deceive me, that he has no designs on that Sorokina, that he is not in love with Kitty, and will not be unfaithful to me? I know all that, but that does not make it easier for me. If, without loving me, he is kind and tender to me from a sense of duty, but what I desire is lacking, that would be a thousand times worse than anger. It would be hell. And that is just how it is.
He has long ceased to love me, and where love ceases, there hate begins.
I don't know these streets at all. Here is a hill, and houses, and in the houses are people, and more people. There is no end to them, and they all hate one another. Well, supposing I picture to myself what I want, in order to be happy. Well, I get divorced, and Alexei Alexandrovich gives me Seretsa, and I marry Vronsky.
Remembering Karenin, she pictured him to herself with extraordinary vividness, as if he stood before her with his mild, dull, lifeless eyes, the blue veins of his white hands, his intonations, his cracking fingers. And remembering the feeling that had once existed between them, and which had also been called love, she shuddered with revulsion.
Well, I get divorced and become Vronsky's wife.
What then?
Will Kitty cease looking at me as she did this afternoon?
No.
Will Seretsa stop asking and wondering about my two husbands? And between Vronsky and myself, what new feeling can I invent? Is any kind, not of happiness even, but of absence of torture, possible?
No, no, she now answered herself without the least hesitation. It is impossible. Life is sundering us, and I am the cause of his unhappiness and he of mine, and neither he nor I can be made different. Every effort has been made, but the screws have given way.
A beggar woman with a baby. She thinks I pity her.
Are we not all flung into the world only to hate each other and therefore to torment ourselves and others?
There go schoolboys. They are laughing.
Seretsa!
She remembered.
I thought I loved him, too, and was touched at my own tenderness for him. Yet I lived without him and exchanged his love for another's and did not complain of the change as long as the other love satisfied me.
And she thought with disgust of what she called the other love. The clearness with which she now saw her own and everyone else's life pleased her. It's the same with me, and Pyotr, and Theodore, the coachman, and with that tradesman, and with all the people that live away there by the Volga, where those advertisements invite one to go, and everywhere, and always. She thought as she drove up to the low building of the Nijivni station, where the porters ran out to meet her.
"Shall I take a ticket to Obirilovka?" asked Pyotr.
She had quite forgotten where and why she was going, and only understood the question by a great effort.
"Yes," she said, giving him her purse. And hanging her little red handbag on her arm, she descended from the carriage. As she moved among the crowd toward the first-class waiting room, she gradually recalled all the details of her position and the resolutions between which she vacillated. And again hope and despair, alternately chafing the old sores, lacerated the wounds of her tortured and violently fluttering heart. Sitting on the star-shaped couch, waiting for her train, she looked with repulsion at those who passed in and out. They were all objectionable to her. She thought now of how she would reach the station and would write him a note, and of what she would write, and of how he was now, without understanding her sufferings, complaining of his position to his mother, and of how she would enter the room and what she would say to him. And then she thought how happy life might still be, and how tormentingly she loved and hated him, and how dreadfully her heart was beating.
Chapter 31. The bell rang. Some young men, ugly and bold-faced, passed by hurriedly and yet attentive to the impression they created. Piotr, in his livery and gaiters, with his dull, animal face, also crossed the room and came to her to see her into the train. Two noisy men became quiet as she passed them on the platform, and one of them whispered to the other something about her. Something nasty, of course. She mounted the high step of the railway carriage and seated herself in an empty compartment on the dirty, though once white, cover of the spring seat. Piotr, with a stupid smile, raised his gold-braided hat to take leave of her. An insolent guard slammed the door and drew the latch. A misshapen lady with a bustle, Anna mentally stripped that woman and was horrified at her deformity, and a girl, laughing affectedly, ran past outside.
"Katerina Andreevna has everything, ma tante," cried the little girl.
"Quite a child, and yet already affected and pulling faces," thought Anna. In order not to see anyone, she rose quickly and sat down at the opposite window of the empty compartment. A grimy, misshaped peasant in a cap from under which his tousled hair stuck out, passed that window, stooping over the carriage wheels.
"There is something familiar about that misshaped peasant," she thought.
And remembering her dream, she went to the opposite door, trembling with fright. The guard opened it to let in a husband and wife.
"Do you wish to get out?"
Anna did not answer. Neither the guard nor those entering noticed the horror on her face beneath the veil. She went back to her corner and sat down. The couple sat down opposite her, attentively but stealthily examining her dress. Both the husband and the wife seemed to Anna disgusting. The husband asked if she would allow him to smoke, evidently not because he wanted to, but to enter into conversation with her. Having received her permission, he began speaking to his wife in French about things he wanted to speak about still less than he wanted to smoke. They talked nonsense, insincerely, only in order that she should hear them. Anna saw distinctly how weary they were of one another and how they hated each other. And it was impossible not to hate such ugly wretches. She heard the second bell ring, and then a moving of luggage, noise, shouting, and laughter. It was so clear to Anna that no one had any cause for joy that this laughter jarred on her painfully, and she wished to stop her ears, not to hear it. At last the third bell rang, the engine whistled and creaked, the coupling chains gave a jerk, and the husband crossed himself. It would be interesting to ask him what he means by it, thought Anna, regarding him spitefully. She looked out of the window, past the lady, at the people on the platform who had been seeing the train off, and who appeared to be gliding backward. With rhythmic jerks over the joints of the rails, the carriage in which Anna sat rattled past the platform and a brick wall, past the signals and some other carriages.
The sound of wheels slightly ringing against the rails became more rhythmical and smooth. The bright evening sunshine shone through the window, and a breeze moved the blind. Anna forgot her fellow travellers. Softly rocked by the motion of the carriage and inhaling the fresh air, she again began to think.
Where did I leave off?
At the point that I cannot imagine a situation in which life would not be a torment, that we all have been created in order to suffer, and that we all know this and all try to invent means of deceiving ourselves. But when you see the truth, what are you to do?
Reason has been given to man to enable him to escape from his troubles, said the lady in French, evidently pleased with her phrase and mincing with her tongue.
These words seemed to answer Anna's thought.
To escape from his troubles,
Anna mentally repeated. And glancing at the red-cheeked husband and his thin wife, she saw that the sickly wife considered herself misunderstood, and that the husband deceived her and encouraged her in her opinion of herself. Directing her searchlight upon them, Anna thought she saw their story and all the hidden recesses of their souls. But there was nothing of interest there, and she continued her reflections.
Yes, it troubles me very much, and reason was given us to enable us to escape. Therefore, I must escape.
Why not put out the candle if there is nothing more to look at?
If everything is repulsive to look at. But how?
Why did the guard run past holding the handrail? Why are those young men in the next carriage shouting? Why are they talking and laughing? It's all untrue, all lies, all deception, all evil. When the train stopped at the station, Anna got out with the crowd of passengers, and shunning them as if they were lepers, stopped on the platform trying to remember why she had come there and what she had intended to do. Everything that had appeared possible before was now so difficult to grasp, especially in this noisy crowd of odious people who would not leave her in peace. Porters rushed up, offering their services. Young men passed along the platform, clattering their heels on the planks, talking loudly and gazing at her, and people she met tried to get out of her way on the wrong side. Recollecting that she meant to go on if there was no reply, she stopped a porter and asked him whether there was not a coachman bringing a note from Count Vronsky there.
Count Vronsky? Someone from there was here just now to meet the Princess Sorokina and her daughter. What is the coachman like?
While she was talking to the porter, Mikhail, the coachman, rosy and cheerful, came up in his smart blue coat with a watch chain, evidently proud of having carried out his errand so well, and handed her a note. She opened it, and her heart sank even before she read it. "Very sorry the note did not catch me. I shall be back at 10," Vronsky wrote in a careless hand.
"Yes, I expected it," she said to herself with a malicious smile. "All right. You may go home," she said softly to Mikhail.
She spoke softly because the rapid beating of her heart impeded her breathing.
"No, I will not let you torture me," she thought,
addressing her threat not to him nor to herself, but to that which forced her to suffer, and she walked along the platform past the station buildings. Two maidservants, strolling about on the platform, turned their heads to look at her and made some audible remarks about her dress. "It's real," they said of the lace she was wearing. The young men did not leave her in peace. Gazing into her face and laughing and shouting unnaturally, they again passed by. The station master asked her in passing whether she was going on. A boy selling kvass fixed his eyes on her.
"Oh, God, where am I to go?" she thought, walking further and further along the platform.
She stopped at the end of it. Some ladies and children who had come to meet a spectacled gentleman and were laughing and talking noisily became silent and gazed at her as she passed them.
She walked faster away from them to the very end of the platform. A goods train was approaching. The platform shook, and it seemed to her as if she were again in the train. Suddenly remembering the man who had been run over the day she first met Vronsky, she realized what she had to do. Quickly and lightly descending the steps that led from the water tank to the rails, she stopped close to the passing train. She looked at the bottom of the trucks, at the bolts and chains and large iron wheels of the slowly moving front truck, and tried to estimate the middle point between the front and back wheels and the moment when that point would be opposite her. "There," she said to herself, looking at the shadow of the truck on the mingled sand and coal dust which covered the sleepers. "There, into the very middle, and I shall punish him and escape from everybody and from myself." She wanted to fall halfway between the wheels of the front truck, which was drawing level with her, but the little red handbag, which she began to take off her arm, delayed her, and then it was too late. The middle had passed her. She was obliged to wait for the next truck. A feeling seized her like that she had experienced when preparing to enter the water in bathing, and she crossed herself. The familiar gesture of making the sign of the cross called up a whole series of girlish and childish memories, and suddenly the darkness that obscured everything for her broke, and life showed itself to her for an instant with all its bright past joys. But she did not take her eyes off the wheels of the approaching second truck, and at the very moment when the midway point between the wheels drew level, she threw away her red bag, and drawing her head down between her shoulders, threw herself forward on her hands under the truck. And with a light movement, as if preparing to rise again, immediately dropped on her knees. And at the same moment she was horror-struck at what she was doing.
"Where am I? What am I doing? Why?"
She wished to rise, to throw herself back, but something huge and relentless struck her on the head and dragged her down.
"God forgive me everything,"
she said, feeling the impossibility of struggling. A little peasant, muttering something, was working at the rails. The candle, by the light of which she had been reading that book filled with anxieties, deceptions, grief, and evil, flared up with a brighter light, lit up for her all that had before been dark, crackled, began to flicker, and went out forever. Part 8. Chapter 1. Nearly 2 months had gone by. It was already the middle of the hot summer, but Sergei Ivanich Koznishev was only now preparing to leave Moscow. In Koznishev's life during that time, events of importance for him had taken place. His book, the result of 6 years' labor, entitled An Attempt to Review the Foundations and Forms of Government of Europe and Russia, had been finished a year ago. Some parts of it and the introduction had appeared in periodicals, and other parts had been read by Koznishev to people of his set, so that the ideas of the work could not be very novel to the public. But all the same, Koznishev expected that the publication of the book would create a serious impression on society, and if not a revolution in science, at any rate a strong agitation in the scientific world. The book had been issued last year after careful revision, and had been sent out to the booksellers. Not asking anyone about it, reluctantly and with feigned indifference replying to his friends' inquiries as to how it was going, and not even asking the booksellers how it was selling, Koznishev watched keenly and with strained attention for the first impression his book would produce in society and in literature. But a week passed, and another, and a third, and no impression was noticeable in society. His friends, the specialists and the scholars, sometimes, from politeness, mentioned it. His other acquaintances,
not interested in learned works, did not mention it to him at all. In society, now particularly occupied with something else, absolute indifference reigned. In the periodicals also, for a whole month, there had not been any mention of the book. Koznishev had calculated exactly the time necessary for a review to be written, but a month passed, and another, and the silence continued. Only in the Northern Beetle, in a facetious feuilleton about the singer Drabanti who had lost his voice, were a few contemptuous remarks interpolated about Koznishev's book, indicating that it had long ago been condemned by everybody and consigned to general ridicule. At last, in the third month, a criticism appeared in a serious magazine. Koznishev knew the author of the article. He had met him once at Golubkov's. The author was a very young and sickly journalist, very bold as a writer, but extremely uneducated and shy in personal intercourse. Despite his entire contempt for this man, Koznishev began reading the review most respectfully. The article was horrible. The critic had evidently understood the book in an impossible way, but he had so adroitly selected his quotations that to those who had not read the book, and evidently hardly anyone had read it, it would appear quite clear that the whole book was nothing but a collection of high-sounding words, not even used appropriately, as was indicated by notes of interrogation, and that its author was a totally ignorant man. All this was put with so much wit that Koznishev himself would not have been averse to wielding it, and that was what was dreadful. Notwithstanding the thorough conscientiousness with which Koznishev verified the correctness of the critic's arguments, he did not dwell for a moment on the deficiencies and mistakes which were ridiculed, but at once involuntarily began to recall his meeting and conversation with the author of the review down to the minutest details. "Did not I offend him in some way?" he asked himself. And remembering how, when he met him, he had corrected the young man's use of a word that betrayed ignorance, Koznishev found an explanation of the article. That review was followed by dead silence, both in print and in conversation, concerning the book, and Koznishev saw that his 6 years' work, carried out with so much devotion and labour, was entirely thrown away. His position was the more painful because, having finished his book, he no longer had any literary work such as had previously occupied the greater part of his time. He was intelligent, well-educated, healthy, and active, but did not know how to employ his energy. Discussions in drawing-rooms, at meetings, at assemblies, in committees, and everywhere where one could speak, took up part of his time. But, as an habitual town-dweller, he did not allow himself to be entirely absorbed by discussions, as his inexperienced brother did when he was in Moscow. So he had much superfluous leisure and mental energy. Fortunately for him, at this most trying time after the failure of his book, in place of the questions of dissent, our American friends, the Samara famine, the exhibitions, and spiritualism, the Slavonic question, which had previously only smouldered in society, came to the front, and Koznishev, who had previously been one of the promoters of that cause, devoted himself to it entirely. Among the people to whom he belonged, nothing was written or talked about at that time except the Serbian War. Everything that the idle crowd usually does to kill time, it now did for the benefit of the Slavs. Balls, concerts, dinners, speeches, ladies' dresses, beer, restaurants, all bore witness to our sympathy with the Slavs. With much that was spoken and written on the subject, Koznishev did not agree in detail. He saw that the Slav question had become one of those fashionable diversions which, ever succeeding one another, served to occupy society. He saw that too many people took up the question from interested motives. He admitted that the papers published much that was unnecessary and exaggerated with the sole aim of drawing attention to themselves, each outcrying the other. He saw that amid this general elation in society, those who were unsuccessful or discontented leapt to the front and shouted louder than anyone else. Commanders-in-chief without armies, ministers without portfolios, journalists without papers, and party leaders without followers. He saw there was much that was frivolous and ridiculous.
but he also saw and admitted the unquestionable and ever-growing enthusiasm which was uniting all classes of society and with which one could not help sympathizing. The massacre of our co-religionists and brother Slavs evoked sympathy for the sufferers and indignation against their oppressors, and the heroism of the Serbs and Montenegrins, fighting for a great cause, aroused in the whole nation a desire to help their brothers not only with words, but by deeds. Also, there was an accompanying fact that pleased Koznishev. It was the manifestation of public opinion. The nation had definitely expressed its wishes. As Koznishev put it, the soul of the nation had become articulate. The more he went into this question, the clearer it seemed to him that it was a matter which would attain enormous proportions and become epoch-making. He devoted himself completely to the service of that great movement and forgot to think about his book. His whole time was now so taken up that he was unable to answer all the letters and demands addressed to him. After working all through the spring and part of the summer, it was not till July that he prepared to go to his brothers in the country. He went, both to enjoy a fortnight's rest and, in that holy of holies of the people, the very heart of the country, to enjoy the sight of that uplift of the national spirit of which he and all the town-dwellers were fully convinced. Katavasov, who had promised Levin to visit him and had long been meaning to keep that promise, accompanied Koznishev. Chapter 2. Hardly had Koznishev and Katavasov reached the station, got out of their carriage and looked for the footman who had followed with their luggage, before some volunteers drove up with four izvozchiks. The volunteers were met by ladies who brought them nosegays, and who, with the crowd that rushed after them, accompanied them into the station. One of the ladies who had met the volunteers spoke to Koznishev at the exit from the waiting room. "You too have come to see them off?" she asked in French.
"No, Princess, I am going to my brother's for a rest."
"And do you always come to see them off?" he asked with a slight smile. "How can one help it?" replied the Princess. "Is it true that 800 have already gone from here? Malvinsky would not believe me."
"More than 800. Counting those who did not go from Moscow direct, more than 1,000, said Koznishev.
"There now, I said so," the lady said, joyfully. "And isn't it true that about 1,000,000 rubles have been collected?"
"More than that, Princess."
"And what a telegram there is today! They have beaten the Turks again."
"Yes, I read it," he answered.
They were talking of the latest telegram, confirming the report that for 3 consecutive days the Turks had been beaten at all points and were in flight, and that a decisive battle was expected next day. "Oh, I say, there is a splendid young man who wants to go. I don't know why they are making difficulties. I wish to speak to you about him. I know him. Please write a note for him. He was sent by the Countess Lydia Ivanovna." Having obtained such details as the princess could give about the young petitioner, Koznishev went into the first-class waiting room, wrote a note to the person on whom the decision depended, and gave it to the princess. "Do you know that the well-known Count Vronsky is going by this train?" remarked the princess, with a triumphant and significant smile, when Koznishev had found her again and given her the note.
"I heard he was going, but did not know when."
"Going by this train?" "I have seen him. He is here. Only his mother is seeing him off. After all, it is the best thing he could do."
"Oh, yes, certainly."
While they were speaking, the crowd rushed past them toward the dining table. They, too, moved on, and heard the loud voice of a man who, with a glass in his hand, was making a speech to the volunteers.
"To serve the faith, humanity, and our brothers," said the gentleman, raising his voice more and more. "Mother Moscow blesses you in the great undertaking. Zhivyo!" he concluded in a loud and tearful voice. Everyone shouted, "Zhivyo!" and a fresh crowd surged into the refreshment room, nearly knocking the princess off her feet.
"Ah, princess, what do you think of that?"
said Oblonsky, beaming with a joyous smile as he suddenly appeared in the midst of the crowd.
"Wasn't it finely and cordially expressed? Bravo! And Sergei Ivanich, now you should say something, so that,
Just a few words, you know, of encouragement. You're doing so well, he added, with an affectionate, respectful, and solicitous smile, gently pushing Koznishev forward by the arm.
No, I am just going.
Where to?
To my brother's in the country, answered Koznishev.
Oh, then you'll see my wife. I have written to her, but you'll see her sooner. Please tell her you have seen me, and it's all right. She will understand.